Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the New Testament, the Acts of the Apostles, the Epistles, and the Book of Revelation. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, and our guest and author of the series is Ron Eldred, and both of us teach at John Paul II Catholic High, the small Catholic High at 12 points. Ron, welcome to the program. We've been talking about St. Paul's doctrine about justification. We talked some about Council of Trent, what it said about justification, which probably was the council on justification. It was such an important issue at the time. And we've been talking about justification helps us share the divinity of Christ. So in regard to sanctification and justification, what about this term divinization, or sharing the divinity of Christ? That could be open to a lot of different interpretations.
The process of divinized is called divinization, which one source defines as the process of making divine the deification of an earthly entity, individual, group, or activity. The source states that in Christian theology, divinization or deification or making divine, or in Greek, theosis, is the transforming effect of divine grace. What the Catholic Church has in mind regarding divinization in divine filiation, that is becoming, a son or a daughter of God the Father, that is the process of becoming a child of God, which means the divine divinized person comes, in the words of one source, to share in the life and role of Jesus Christ. Sometimes it's called, partaking of the divine nature. You hear that term used quite a bit too. The term is best understood in the filial relationship between God the Father and the Son, and of the Father and all other human beings. The second person of the Holy Trinity is the Father's Son by nature. All human persons become the Father's sons and daughters by adoption and by grace because they're created. They don't have the same nature. They have a created nature. Catechism states of the matter, quote, "The Word became flesh to make us partakers of the divine nature. For this is why the Word became flesh. And the Son of God became the Son of Man, so that man, by entering into communion with the Word, and thus receiving a divine sonship, might become a son of God. For the Son of God became man, so that we might become God. The only begotten Son of God, wanting to make us sharers in his divinity, assumed our nature so that he made man, might make men gods." That is from the Catechism, paragraph 2782.
Okay, so divine filiation implies divinization.
Yes. St. Athanasius tells us that, quote, "The Son of God became man so that we might become God." St. Peter makes us sharers in the divine nature in 2 Peter 1, verse 4. Scott Hahn states in his First Comes Love, Finding Your Family in the Church and the Trinity, that, quote, "Divine filiation is the centerpiece of the gospel, the good news. It is the reason why man was saved, and is also the purpose behind baptism." End of quote. Pope John Paul II said that divine filiation is the deepest mystery of the Christian vocation and the culminating point of the mystery of our Christian life. We share in salvation, which is not only deliverance from evil, but is first of all the fullness of good, of the supreme good of the sonship of God. Pope Benedict XVI wrote in his Jesus of Nazareth, that's the first volume, I believe. The second volume came out about a year ago. He says, quote, the fathers of the church say that when God created man in his image, he looked toward the Christ who was to come and created man according to the image of the new Adam, the man who is the criterion of the human. Jesus is the Son in the strict sense. He is of one substance with the Father. He wants to draw all of us into his humanity, so into this sonship, into his total belonging to God. End of quote.
Well, St. Paul has quite a bit to say about divine filiation. Can you tell us something about that?
It was he who first started to develop the idea of divine filiation. He wrote in Romans 8 that, quote, for all who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God. For you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the spirit of sonship. When we cry, Abba, Father, it is the Spirit himself bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ. Provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. This is a quote from Romans 8, verses 14 through 17.
Well, Ron, didn't the early church fathers, especially the fathers in the Greek Eastern Church, have a lot to say about deification of God's children?
Yes, they did. For example, I'll quote a few of these. St. Irenaeus of Lyon stated that God became what we are in order to make us what he is himself. St. Clement of Alexandria says that he who obeys the Lord and follows the prophecy given through him becomes a God while still moving about in the flesh. St. Athanasius wrote, quote, God became man so that man might become gods. St. Cyril of Alexandria says that, quote, we called temples of God and indeed gods, and so we are. St. Basil the Great, the founder of Eastern monasticism, stated that becoming a god is the highest goal of all. And finally, St. Gregory of Nazianzus implores us to become gods for God's sake, since God became man for our sake.
So all those quotations are becoming God, and God with a small g means that we are sons and daughters of God.
Become partakers of the divine nature.
Okay, and it's an attempt to explain a mystery.
Yes.
Okay, how about St. Augustine? Did he have anything to say about human deification?
Yes, for this is a major theme in his theology, I believe. He wrote in this regard, quote, I am the food of growing men. Grow, and thou shalt feed upon me. Nor shalt thou convert me like the food of thy flesh into thee, for thou shalt be converted into me. In one of his published sermons, he says, to make human beings God, he was made man who was God. But he cautions us, though, that this deification is given to us by grace, not by making us part of the divine essence itself. He states in this regard, it is clear that he called men gods, being deified by his grace and not born of his substance. For he justified, who is just of himself and not from another. And he deifies, who is God of himself and not by participation in another. If we have been made sons of God, we have been made gods. But this is by grace of adoption, and not of the nature of our begetter. In other words, we actually don't become of the same essence, of the same nature, of the same being. We're not consubstantial with the Father. Only the Son can be that. He is of the same nature as the Father, or one in being with the Father. He's uncreated being and we're a created being. That, of course, is the great difference.
All right, how about the great St. Thomas Aquinas? He always usually has some good insight.
Yes, he wrote of this matter, "The gift of grace surpasses every capability of created nature, since it is nothing short of a partaking of the divine nature, which exceeds every other nature. And thus it is possible that any creature should cause grace. And thus it is impossible that any creature should cause grace. For it is as necessary that God alone should deify, bestowing a partaking of the divine nature by a participated likeness, as it is impossible that anything save fire should enkindle." Elsewhere he wrote, "God's special love, whereby he draws the rational creature above the condition of its nature to a participation of the divine good." He approves of St. Augustine's statement that God was made man, that man might be made God.
Okay, so obviously, as you're explaining so well, we have to take all these things as far as what the church has traditionally understood them to be, because just taken isolated, they could be certainly really misunderstood.
That's true.
That God made man, that man might be made God. Well, it has to be taken in the whole context of St. Augustine's statement and the things you've been explaining. We also made a reference to human deification, or becoming godlike, during the celebration of the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. You want to say a word about that?
The priest during the offertory prays, quote, "By the mystery of this water and wine, may we come to share in the divinity of Christ, who humbled himself to share in our humanity." Moreover, the preface for Ascension Thursday states that Christ ascended into heaven to claim for us a share in his divine life. One Catholic source states that, in actuality, theosis is the God-ordained purpose of human existence. God created Adam and Eve in his image so that they could participate in his life.
Okay, so we have to be very careful, as you have been, in discussing this topic. It could easily lead itself to misunderstanding.
That's very true. It must be made perfectly clear what is meant by humans becoming deified and what is not meant. One Orthodox Catholic source states that divinization, or theosis, is, quote, "a union of grace which mysteriously assimilates a rational creature to the Creator." The divinized creature is conformed perfectly to the divine image and likeness, permeated with the life and love of God, and possesses an immediate, though not comprehensive, vision of the divine nature and an intimate relationship with the three divine persons. Yet despite the profound intimacy of this union, the creature always remains essentially distinct from God. In other words, divinization doesn't change a person's human nature into a divine nature, but instead transforms and configures the person to Christ. The divinized or deified person still possesses a human nature, but has become transformed in Christ, closely configured to Christ by grace, or God's presence in him, that is, the indwelling Trinity. The source says that, quote, "The deified soul is filled with God, permeated with divine life, power, glory, and love. Yet no confusion or change occurs between his or her created substance and the uncreated substance of God. Though in intimate contact, they remain distinct, so that the creature may enjoy the beauty of God without the violation of his or her selfhood." That ends that quote. Then the author goes on to describe how the Church Fathers had compared divinization to the casting of metal in a furnace. She states that as the metal will take on the color and heat of the fire while remaining metal, so the divinized soul radiates the glory of God and resembles the Holy One as closely as a creature possibly can. Yet she remains a creature essentially distinct in both nature and person. I think you can see this when you see a saint. You know, we put a halo around their head. This halo, really what it's reflecting, is God dwelling in this person's soul, and they become so holy and so intimate with God, achieving union with God, that the divinity shines through their humanity.
Well, when Jesus was on transfigured, his divinity, his absolute substantial divinity, flamed through, and his clothes were as white as snow, and his face was shining like the sun. So, in a similar but not same way, that we have a radiance and a new reality flames forth from a person in sanctifying grace, a grace that sanctifies us, a grace that illuminates us, makes us a different person and closeness to our Lord.
Of course, what Jesus was doing is letting his divinity shine through his humanity. You take a lot of the great saints, take Mother Cabrini, for example. When she would pray at night, she would actually light up like the sun. She wouldn't let anybody sleep in a room with her or anything like that, because in the early years of her early religious order, one of the young nuns had stayed with her and saw her light up like that, so she went and told all the rest of the nuns. Mother was very upset about that because she was very humble, so she never would let anyone else stay with her when they were traveling. Mm-hmm. But the people would go by her room at night with the door shut, and they could see a brilliant light shining at the bottom of the door because she was praying, and the Trinity dwelling in her soul, and she achieved such a close union with God, such a intimate participation in the inner life of the Trinity, that she actually lit up like the sun.
So it's all the mystery of participating, as Jesus said, when we are born again of water and the Spirit, something really new. We become a new creature in Christ, as St. Paul talks about it. It's something real that happens to a person that brings us closer and in similarity to Jesus. Well, when does this divinization, or this divine possession, take place?
We recently, in an earlier session, considered this topic when we discussed St. Paul's theology of original sin and the effects of sanctifying grace on the soul. As we discussed, divinization begins at baptism. One Catholic source says that divinization starts, quote, when God's as uncreated grace elevates the soul by means of sanctifying grace, making her a partaker in the divine nature. The devout soul will grow in grace and deepen his or her relationship with God through prayer, the Mass, fasting, almsgiving, works of mercy, devout use of sacramentals, etc. If one practices contemplative prayer, he or she may experience a foretaste of theosis in the unity state, the highest state of prayer, and the closest one can come to full divinization in this life. And we considered in some detail the various stages of holiness, the purgative, illuminative, and unitive in our series on the universal call to holiness. The unitive way is the third and final stage of Christian perfection beyond the purgative and illuminative ways. Of this stage, Father John Hardin, whom we've quoted many times in this series, says, quote, its principal feature is a more or less constant awareness of God's presence and a habitual disposition of conformity to the will of God, end of quote. As we discussed in that series, the person who has reached the unity stage prays ceaselessly by employing all of the forms of prayer, verbal, meditative, and especially contemplative. Contemplative prayer is a form of prayer that God provides for those who are especially holy and enjoy a close relationship with Him or a close friendship with Him. Great saints like St. Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross not only reached the unity stage of holiness and perfection, but were made doctors of the Church for their writings on this subject.
Okay, so just to distinguish, as powerful as the unitive, that the third stage, purgative, illuminative, and the unitive way, as some spiritual writers talk about, the unitive stage doesn't still compare with the beatific vision, seeing God face to face in heaven.
Yes, that's true. The beatific vision is the immediate knowledge of God, which the angels and saints enjoy in heaven, and which we hopefully may enjoy someday, God willing, if we persevere in grace. Since creatures cannot naturally contemplate divinity because of our fallen nature, God elevates our minds by means of the light of glory, and then unites our elevated intellects directly to the divine nature, so that we may see God face to face, as he is, as sometimes it's put. One Catholic scholar writes regarding this matter, quote, "Our intimate union with God will enable us to participate to a limited degree in God's own knowledge of creation. We will perceive in God the mysteries of the faith, the divine plan for our salvation, and the lives of our loved ones on earth." This, of course, is after we've gone to heaven, hopefully. "We, like the rest of the saints, will be able to hear any prayers they address to us and can pray for their needs. And since our demonized wills will be in perfect conformity with the will of God, we will pray according to God's will for them. Furthermore, demonization will not only affect the soul, but as our source states, at the resurrection, the demonized soul will rejoin his or her former body, which now glorified and incorruptible, will be demonized with the soul, and both will enjoy the bliss of heaven forever." Of course, this is called, you know, the glorified body.
That's important, and it reminds us that the importance of the body, because the Church clearly teaches us that not only will we have our body at the last judgment to be with us forever in heaven or with us forever in hell, because the body is really part of us, and that we are not really completely humans without our body reunited to our soul. And so we are reminded that as we work here on earth and live in a body-soul, that we will eventually have our eternity with God in the beatific vision, or seeing God face to face in our Father's house. Well, Ron, what does St. Paul have to say about the beatific vision, or this sight of God in the next life?
Paul says in 1 Timothy 6:16 that God, quote, "dwells in unapproachable light, whom no one has ever even seen or can see," end of quote. His most famous saying on the matter is found in 1 Corinthians 13:12, where he states, quote, "For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall understand fully, even as I have been fully understood," end of quote. Another well-known statement he makes on the subject is 1 Corinthians 2:9, where he writes that, quote, "Eye has not seen and ear has not heard, and what has not entered the human heart is what God has prepared for those who love him," end of quote.
Okay, since the divinized person who achieves union with God in this life doesn't see God face to face, what are the chief benefits of the unitive stage of holiness and perfection?
One source says of this matter, since the demonized person always act according to God's will, their actions are not merely their own, for God works in them. Thus their actions have a certain divine quality. Even as the actions of Christ are both divine and human, so those of the just man are godlike, performed at once by God and by man. Some of the principal benefits of reaching the summit, identified by Father Thomas DeVay Dubé and the fire within are as follows. I might say that Father Dubé, of course, was until he died about a year ago, year and a half ago, was a leading, one of the world's leading spiritual directors and theologians of spiritual theology. And in his book, The Fire Within, he actually lists about 15 or 20, I have maybe 9 or 10 here, a person who reaches this height of holiness in this life would enjoy peace and refreshment of mind and soul, experience heroic virtue, the ability to practice virtue in an extraordinary way, innocence of evil, cessation of inner suffering, cessation of imperfections, remarkable delight in God's creation, constant awareness of God's presence. All actions are performed for God and a fullness of joy.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful state to achieve. We talk about it would certainly be nice to be free from all worry that bothers us in this life. And the closer we come to God and doing God's will, the more that takes place where we become full of joy and we get rid of our not only sins but imperfections. We live in the constant presence of God. So what a beautiful goal to strive for. Go through the purgative way to the illuminative way. Illuminative way means when we try to especially follow the virtues of Jesus. And then this unitive way being so joined to the will of God. Well, of course, this doesn't mean that God overrides or replaces our own will, our free will, the greatest of the gifts with our mind that God has given to us. We still have freedom.
Even in the unity stage, we do. That's right. Father Hardin says that, quote, it means that the will of a demonized person submits and perfectly conforms to the divine will. It still exists and acts. The divine will neither annihilates nor renders it passive, nor does the limited participation in God's knowledge make the creature omniscient, for it is only a partial participation. A demonized soul only comprehends that which pertains to him or herself and to his or her place in the divine plan. Nature remains incomprehensible to her finite mind. End of quote.
Oh, it looks like our time is running out. So let's us conclude there. And to our listening audience, we say may God bless you all, always, and always.